2006, an Oxford scientist by the name of Richard Dawkins published a best-selling book called The God Delusion. It was, just as the title sounds, a book that set out to criticize religious belief, in particular to criticize belief in the Christian faith. Since that time, Dawkins has been one of the most prominent public intellectual opponents of Christianity, and he's rarely missed an opportunity to speak out against what he regards to be both an irrational and immoral religion. For that reason, I was very surprised just recently when I saw in the news reports about Richard Dawkins speaking positively about Christianity. In fact, going so far as to call himself a cultural Christian. In an interview with a reporter where they were discussing the recent rise of Islam within England, Dawkins said that although he doesn't believe Christian claims about God, he is still very grateful to live in a country that has been shaped by Christian morality. And he worries about losing that moral influence in English society. "So I call myself a cultural Christian," he said, "and I think it would be truly dreadful if we substituted any alternative religion." To have Richard Dawkins, of all people, say something so positive and supportive of Christianity was, as you can imagine, something of a shock to a lot of people. But interestingly, Dawkins wasn't the first famous atheist to change his tune on Christianity. Just 4 months prior, one of his former atheistic colleagues and another prominent public critic of Christianity, a woman named Ayan Hirsi Ali, she caused a minor uproar when she published an article entitled, "Why I Am Now a Christian." And in that article, she said something very similar to Dawkins. Like him, she said that she still struggles to believe what Christianity says about God and Jesus. Nevertheless, whereas she had formerly rejected Christianity, she now chooses to embrace it because she now recognizes that it offers a much better and a much more beautiful and more humane way of life than either the Muslim faith in which she was raised or the atheism which she long championed. And Dawkins and Ali aren't alone. Over the past several years, numerous prominent public figures have begun to identify with the Christian faith, not because they're necessarily convinced that what the Bible says about God or the resurrection of Jesus is true, but because they have realized that its moral vision is much better than any other alternative. And when you read a book like Deuteronomy, you can begin to understand why that might be true. After all, the way of life and the sort of social vision that Moses commends is a way of life based on the love of God and the love of one's neighbor. It's a way of life that gives attention to the poor and to those in need, as we saw in Deuteronomy 15. It's a way of life that tries to protect the powerless from the abuse of the powerful. It's a way of life built on an attitude of humility and gratitude and celebration and the goods that we all receive. Even if the people of Israel never perfectly followed these laws, you can't deny that there's something deeply attractive about the kind of society that they commend, at least most of the time. But if you read far enough, you'll start coming across some laws that seem less attractive. Laws that seem like they're not teaching you how to love your neighbor, but they're teaching you how you can commit violence against your neighbor. In particular, I'm thinking about the laws that we find in Deuteronomy chapters 19 and 20, which focus on violent punishments against criminals and on how to wage war. In these chapters, we find laws talking about handing someone over to be executed, about taking an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth, and about enjoying the spoils of war. And when you're reading them, you might be tempted to think, well, this isn't beautiful. This sounds barbaric. At least that's what some people think. But I'd like to suggest that there's actually much more to these laws than that. And when you read them closely, and you take into consideration the context in which they were written, you'll realize these laws aren't barbaric, nor do they promote violence. In fact, as with all of Deuteronomy, what these laws are doing is teaching the Israelites what it means to love their neighbors well. To explain what I mean, I'm going to look briefly at the laws in chapter 19 and then the laws in chapter 20. And I'm sorry, you'll have to forgive me. I couldn't resist. I'm going to name these two sections after two famous works of Russian literature. So first we'll talk about crime and punishment, and then we'll talk about war and peace. It's hard to read Deuteronomy 19 as a modern person and not feel unsettled, or at least a little confused. On the one hand, it seems to set up a system of sanctuary cities that people can flee to after they've killed someone and escape punishment. On the other hand, it says that some of those people should be punished, and not only that, that they should be punished by being handed over to someone who will kill them. To quote verse 12, "Then the elders of his city shall send and take him from there and hand him over to the avenger of blood so that he may die." After that, the chapter goes on to give some instructions about people who commit perjury in front of a judge. In and of itself, there's nothing bad about that. We have laws against perjury too. But once again, the penalty seems to be incredibly harsh. It shall be life for life, eye for eye, tooth for tooth, hand for hand, foot for foot. What should we make of these laws? And why are they so terribly violent? Well, let's start with that second set of laws, the ones about perjury. The law says that if any person brings a charge of crime or a charge of wrongdoing against another person, and that charge, the accusation, turns out to be untrue, then the punishment against the perjurer must be severe. If the person accusing his neighbor turns out to be lying, then Moses says, "Then you shall do to him as he had meant to do to his brother." And then after that, it goes on to add the description of a life for a life, an eye for an eye, and so on and so forth. If you read that verse in isolation, then the punishment may sound violent and barbaric. But as the Jewish philosopher Leon Cass points out, this punishment doesn't actually promote violence. Quite the opposite. What this law actually does is limit and restrict violence. This law limits the impulse to take revenge by restricting the amount, no more than an eye for an eye, and the object of punishment. Only the perpetrator shall be punished, not also or instead his wife or his children. But it does more than that as well. Not only does this punishment work to limit and prevent personal revenge and vengeance, it also ensures that the Israelites will take the prohibition in the Ten Commandments, the prohibition about bearing false witness, with the utmost seriousness. In fact, that's exactly the reason that Deuteronomy gives for punishing false witnesses this way, so that the rest shall hear and fear and shall never again commit any such evil among you. But what about those earlier laws, the ones about sanctuary cities and putting people to death? Well, if you read them, you'll realize that the purpose and intent of these laws is once again to protect the innocent and to teach us the dignity and sanctity of human life. First, the laws protect the innocent. Moses says that the people have to designate three cities to serve as sanctuary cities, and that they must be equally separated in the land so that no matter where you live, you are still within relatively close distance to one of them. Then, he says, if anyone kills another person unintentionally, for instance, if they're chopping wood and their axe slips and accidentally strikes and kills another person, then they should run to one of these cities and they must be given protection. If, on the other hand, someone kills another person intentionally, if they commit murder, then they will receive no sanctuary. Then that's when the elders of the city are required to hand them over to be executed. But why? Why these wildly inconsistent consequences to murder and accidental manslaughter? In both cases, it turns out that the purpose of the law is the same, to prevent the shedding of innocent blood. As verse 10 says, with reference to the laws about sanctuary cities, "Lest any blood be shed in your land that the Lord your God is giving you for an inheritance, and so the guilt of bloodshed be upon you." And then again, with reference to the command about executing those who commit murder, "Your eye shall not pity him, but you shall purge the guilt of innocent blood from Israel, so it may be well with you." long before God ever gave these laws to Israel, back when Noah first got off the ark, God told Noah that he was allowed to kill animals for food, but he said, "But whoever sheds the blood of man, by man shall his blood be shed, for God made man in his own image." In other words, because human beings are created in the image of God, their lives have incredible dignity and worth, and they must be honored and protected. To take the life of another person is to destroy the image of God. It is a crime of the highest order. And for that reason, the consequences of it, God tells Noah, and then Moses tells the Israelites, must be severe. People have to understand the severity of what they are doing when they shed innocent blood. Of course, there's a lot more that we could say about these laws. But let's turn our attention briefly to the laws we find in chapter 20, the laws about war and peace. If loving your neighbor means anything, surely it means refusing to use violence, right? But when it comes to the history of Israel, that's a problem because they often go to war against neighboring countries. And sometimes they do it in response to the specific instructions of God. So does that mean that God actually condones and promotes war and violence? Does that mean that following God means initiating a militaristic response to anything that threatens you? Well, of course not. That's obvious. But what then are we supposed to do with these practical instructions on how the Israelites should conduct themselves in battle? Well, before we look at these laws in chapter 20, I should make a couple points. First, these laws are not meant to be some kind of full or complete handbook on military conduct, nor are they a treatise on the ethics of war. There are basic instructions for a king who finds himself at war against Israel's enemies. Second, as with all of the laws in this book, there's a great deal in God's instructions here that is specific to the mission and context of the people of Israel, and we can't simply apply it directly to the life of the church. Jesus said that his kingdom is not of this world, and he specifically forbade his followers from defending it with violence. God has not given us a specific land like he did Israel that we must inhabit and cleanse from idolatry. We're living in a different chapter of the biblical story. Nevertheless, those qualifications aside, there's still something remarkable and still something instructive for us about these laws. First, note that God doesn't tell the Israelites that they need to recruit and train a large army to protect them. Actually, to the contrary, in verses 1 through 9, he tells them that when they go to war, even when they are outmatched by the manpower and by the technology of their opponents, they should actually reduce the size of their army by granting multiple exemptions from military service. As Christopher Wright observes about these laws, there is no competitive arms race. The whole spirit of this chapter is actually anti-militaristic. And there's a reason for that. As another Old Testament scholar puts it, the somewhat idealistic approach, you could say, that this chapter takes to military size and strength is actually a reflection. It's a reflection of Deuteronomy's profound conviction that military strength and victory lay ultimately not in the army, but in God. You don't have to trust in a big standing army. Once more, in the verses that follow, Moses gives specific moral guidelines on how the Israelites must conduct themselves in war. Before they can enter into battle, for instance, he says that they must first make a genuine attempt at peace. When you draw near to a city to go to fight against it, offer terms of peace to it. He also limits whom you can execute and how you may treat those you conquer. He even forbids the people from cutting down all the trees around an enemy city, saying, "Are the trees in the field human, that they should be besieged by you?" So in many ways, although this chapter does anticipate that the Israelites will occasionally have to go to war, it still recognizes that they live in a fallen world. Nevertheless, it sets out a vision of warfare that seeks to be both limited and morally just. To quote Christopher Wright once more, when we allow ourselves to see past the slaughter of the Canaanites as a moral stumbling block to the other features of Deuteronomy's rules of war, we can hardly remain unimpressed. Without a Geneva Convention, Deuteronomy advocates human exemptions from combat, requires prior negotiation, prefers nonviolence, limits the treatment of subject populations, allows for execution of male combatants only, demands humane and dignified treatment of female captives, and insists on ecological restraint. I don't know whether someone like Richard Dawkins would approve of the laws on Deuteronomy 19 and 20. Perhaps not. Perhaps he'd simply be repulsed by the advocacy of capital punishment and the anticipation of armed conflict. And as Christians, we must remember our situation is different from ancient Israel. And we interpret these laws through the teaching of Jesus, who taught us to love our enemies and pray for those who persecute us. Nevertheless, even here, even in these chapters where they describe crime and war and punishment, what we find is not a departure from the command to love your neighbor, but a reflection on how to love your neighbor's life, your neighbor's reputation, to love your neighbor well in a world where violence and conflict are inevitable. What we find, in other words, is something deeply good, something that reflects the heart of a God who loves his people and who is committed to fashioning them into a community of justice and love.